All four of the stories that you hear today are going to be user submissions. I just wanted to do this intro really quickly to emphasize and double down on the fact that I want your stories. I want to hear more of your stories. And I love the fact that this whole episode is just user submissions and we don't have to reach out and kind of find our own and go through that whole process. Well, at least Zach doesn't have to, not necessarily me. But it would make his life easier. It would make my life a little easier. And I feel like it makes it more involved for you and for us, because now we're hearing your stories, your personal stories, and not just some random one that we have to reach out and find. You know, the email is on screen right now to use that you send your stories to. And it's obviously as well in the description of every single video that I put out. So, all right, let's get into today's scary neighbor stories, all from you. It was the mid-1990s, and we lived on the border between Mexico and the United States. A muddy river separates El Paso and Juarez, but six bridges reconnect the sister cities, which have more in common with each other than they do with their respective countries. Border culture is its own thing. It's like having a quinceañera and then a sweet 16 the very next year, both equally important. It's about always having salsa to put alongside your turkey and stuffing at Thanksgiving. It's speaking English and Spanish in the same sentence, Spanglish. It's normal and expected, and everyone understands you. Almost everywhere that you shop accepts both pesos and dollars, and there aren't 6 degrees of separation in border culture, because border culture is about finding connections to one another. You know your neighbors, your coworkers, your classmates, and their families, and you become a part of their family, just like they become a part of yours. Your tío Beto might actually be your uncle, but he might also be your sister's best friend's boss. Charlie, my ex, my children's father, was supporting me and our two children while I finished my degree. He worked for his family's construction business during the day, and then he delivered pizza for extra income on the evenings and weekends. Charlie was only 22, while I was barely 20. We were very young parents, but we were very motivated and driven individuals who wanted what was best for our children. We didn't have a lot, but we worked hard for what we did have, and we were very grateful people. The plan was for me to finish my degree and then support our family while Charlie finished his degree. When the story takes place, we were both very young and naive. Charlie came home that afternoon with just enough time to take a short nap before he had to leave for his job delivering pizzas. His parents lived just around the corner, within walking distance, and I decided to walk over there so our apartment would be quiet while Charlie napped, and because we had plans to go over to a friend's place later that evening, play some cards, and Charlie's mom was going to watch over the kids overnight for us. I had already packed their stuff. I tucked the baby into her stroller, pushed the diaper bag underneath it, and then put my shoes on my toddler's feet, and we were off. Charlie's aunts, uncles, and baby cousins were already at his parents' house when I arrived after our brief 5-minute walk. It was pretty typical for them to stop by one of our houses after a day of shopping before heading back over one of the bridges to their homes in Juarez. His mother, Rosalia, was busy making chili rellenos, one of my favorites. Naturally, I stayed to eat dinner and visit with the family. The sun was setting when I decided to kiss my babies goodbye and take my walk back home. As I rounded the apartment building next to ours, I noticed that my car was gone from its parking space. I had an older model Ford Escort that my grandfather had gifted me for my 16th birthday. It was previously his car, and the occasion was an excuse for him to upgrade to something new. He'd owned the car after his retirement. It had very low miles on it and was in pristine condition when he gave it to me. However, at the time of this story, it was a 12-year-old car, and by contrast, Charlie drove a brand new Nissan Sentra. If he opted to take my car, he had some good reason, and I didn't really question it. Naturally, being in the mid-90s, it wasn't like we could just text each other with updates or explanations. I'd find out why he took my car when I saw him later that evening. We lived in what we fondly referred to as the apartment row. There were 5 sets of different apartment complexes all nestled together, one after the other, from one major cross street to another, within a half-mile spread. Conveniently, when facing apartment row, Charlie's cousin Patricia lived in the apartment complex to our right. My cousin, Wyatt, and his wife, Amara, lived in the apartment complex to the left of ours. Wyatt was a police officer, and Amara was a nurse. Wyatt was my oldest cousin. He was 5 years older and fiercely protective of me as well. We were more like siblings than actually cousins, since our grandmother had raised us and we grew up together. Our best friends, Bruce and Denise, lived in the last set of apartment complexes in the apartment row. Everyone involved in this story was a neighbor to some degree, as we're all neighbors to each other down there on the border. Bruce was an E4 in the Army. He was part of the Patriot missile team, and Denise was a stay-at-home mother. There was one apartment complex that separated Bruce and Denise's from Wyatt's and Amara's. It wasn't just proximity that made us all close to one another. It was also that same concept of border culture. We were all a family in that sense. We'd all get together at least once a month to play some cards or board games. When Charlie was finished with work that night, we planned on meeting Bruce and Denise to play some cards. Wyatt had to work until midnight, so we didn't plan on seeing him until much later. Steinbeck was correct when he wrote, "The best laid plans of mice and men go often astray," because that night, nothing would go the way that any of us had planned. Exactly two doors down from Bruce and Denise, two men would knock on a random apartment door. Later, they would say that they chose this particular apartment because they had heard children or babies in the others nearby. Plus, there was a visible light on in this particular unit. A middle-aged man would open up his door to a gun in his face. The two men would then rush him into his bedroom, where he was told to lie face down on his bed. A pillow was folded over the back of his head, and he was executed almost at point-blank range. The pillow muffled enough of the noise to prevent neighbors from being alerted. They then closed the bedroom door and began to make themselves at home. They found the TV remote and rifled through the fridge and the cabinets. They managed to find plenty of beer, but were unsatisfied with the selection of available food, so they decided to order a pizza. In preparation of our get-together, Bruce was also planning on ordering a pizza. Three apartment complexes away, I sat on the couch, reading my latest world literature assignment. I could hear emergency sirens approaching nearby, and while we didn't live in this particularly unsafe neighborhood, it also wasn't that unusual. People would have medical emergencies, car accidents happen. When you're dealing with a dense population crammed into five apartment complexes, sirens was just going to be a part of the life. They did bring Charlie, his co-workers, and my cousins to mind, though. Charlie and both his co-workers because I'd hoped none of them had been in an accident while delivering. My cousin because he could just be one of those sirens that I heard, and I always hoped for his safety. He would recount stories about his job as a police officer, and some of the things that he encountered were nightmare-inducing. His tales always gave me a profound appreciation for my own sheltered life. I found a stopping point in my studies, grabbed my purse and the keys to Charlie's Nissan, and was heading out the door when the phone rang. I picked up the handset and said, "Hello?" It was Denise. "Hey, Genesis. Wyatt's here, and he needs to talk to you." I didn't pick up on how somber she sounded either. Next, I heard Wyatt's voice on the line. "Hey, Jenny." I responded, "Hey, you didn't have to work after all. I was just about to leave. I'll be there in a few minutes." Wyatt continued, "No, Jenny, I am working. I'm on a call right now, and it's about that. Charlie was delivering a pizza to an apartment next door to here. He was robbed at gunpoint." My heart sank. A knot formed in my throat as tears welled up in my eyes. I could barely even ask the question, "Is he all right?" I could hear Wyatt sigh. "He's alive. He was beat up pretty badly, though, and was shot in the shoulder. He was able to make it over here, to Bruce and Denise's. He was able to give us a statement. Bruce is on the way to pick you up now. I'm going to wrap things up here and meet you at the hospital." Hot tears were already falling heavily down my face. I managed to just say, "Okay," but I couldn't hang up the phone. Bruce lightly rapped on the door and walked in. He took the phone from my hand and placed it back on the receiver. He pulled me into one of these big, huge bear hugs and just allowed me to sob. After a long minute, he pushed me back at arm's length, gently squeezed my shoulders, and told me that he's fine. He's gonna be okay. I choked out a weak, "Really?" "Really," he affirmed. "Now let's go." In a zombie-like trance, I walked towards Bruce's truck while he used the spare key that we'd given him to lock up my apartment door. It was about a 30-minute drive to the hospital. Initially, I couldn't form a cohesive sentence, but Bruce filled the silence by explaining what he already knew. Charlie delivered the pizzas to Bruce that he had ordered. He said he was delivering another order a few doors down. He'd cash out at the restaurant and head back over to play some cards. Not but 5 minutes later, Bruce, Denise, and Amara, who'd already arrived, heard two loud pops, which Bruce recognized to be gunshots. Bruce then told Denise to call the police. He went to their coat closet and then pulled down the gun safe, punched in his code, and pulled out his gun. He chambered around and stepped outside. He then saw someone that he didn't recognize getting into the passenger side of my car and sped away. That's when he knew something was wrong. He correctly assumed that Charlie was using my car for deliveries. And as it turned out, Charlie was using my car because he needed to put gas in his Nissan. He'd napped too late to fill it up before work. One apartment away, the front door was open. As he was debating whether or not to approach it further, Bruce heard Charlie beginning to scream for help. He found him leaning up against the foot of a bed, bleeding, with another body on the bed. Blood was seeping into the mattress and covers around that body. He wanted Charlie to remain still, but Charlie insisted they had to leave, get somewhere safe in case those men came back. He helped Charlie up and they returned to his apartment. Charlie sat on a stool in their kitchen while Amara ordered Denise to get her a pair of scissors and some clean towels to stem the bleeding. She then told Denise to call 911 back and have them send an ambulance to their address. As Denise was on the phone, Amara was assessing Charlie's wounds and relaying information for Denise to give back to the 911 operator. Soon afterwards, both the police and EMTs arrived. Charlie was able to give the police a statement of his own. When he saw a delivery going to Bruce and Denise's, he told his manager it was his friend's house and he'd take it. A few minutes later, another order popped up in the same apartment complex. Charlie was happy it would end up being a double delivery. He'd get paid for two runs going practically to the same place. After dropping off the pizzas to Bruce, he went a few doors down and knocked. At first, he didn't notice the gun. He was looking down as he removed the pizzas from the hot bag. When he pulled them out, he looked up and saw the barrel of a gun pointed right at his face. The guy immediately ordered him inside, telling him to put the pizzas down on the coffee table. Charlie complied. He noticed another guy, sitting on the couch and just laughing at him. The guy with the gun then ordered him to give him all of his money. Charlie unsnapped the fanny pack that he carried while making his deliveries, then held it out to the guy. The guy kept the gun pointed right at Charlie, then snatched that fanny pack from him using his unoccupied hand. He tossed it behind him to the guy on the couch, who unzipped it and started counting out the money. Next, the guy with the gun ordered Charlie to give him his wallet and his car keys. Charlie removed his wallet from his back pocket and took out his keys of his front pocket and held them out. The guy didn't take them, but instead turned the gun around and hit Charlie in the face with the butt of the gun. He immediately collapsed to the floor. The guy then proceeded to kick him in the face and in the stomach several more times. The other man on the couch got up and helped deliver a few kicks of his own to Charlie's back. The beating was intense, but fortunately, it was short-lived. They ordered him to get up and move towards the bedroom. Again, Charlie complied. He was dizzy and sore all over. He said he could barely find the energy to do what was being asked of him. It was hard to move. Then, when they'd opened up the bedroom door, began crossing the threshold, he noticed that dead body on the bed. Something snapped in him. He realized he was about to succumb to that same fate. Adrenaline then rushed into his body, giving him the wherewithal to rush in, shutting and locking the door behind him. Realizing what had just happened, the two men began kicking and slamming into the door. And that's when Charlie remembered the gun. He had just enough time to drop to the floor when the first four shots were fired. He thought it was shot number two that penetrated his shoulder as he was dropping to the floor. This was likely a shot that would have hit his abdomen, causing who knows what kind of catastrophic damage, if he hadn't managed to get his body into a lower position. He heard one of the men yelling to the other one, saying to forget about him. Let's just rip the phone cord out of the wall so he couldn't call for help. Then he heard them gathering up what they assumed was all the money, the wallet, and the car keys. And soon after that, he heard that unmistakable sound of my ancient car starting up and peeling away. He slowly unlocked and opened up the bedroom door, but he didn't have the energy to go any further. Instead, he collapsed against the foot of the bed and started calling out for help, praying that those men were really gone. He breathed a sigh of relief when Bruce entered the room. After Charlie had given his statement, Amara rode in the ambulance to the hospital with Charlie. Wyatt was there with five other police officers. He asked Bruce to go get me and then take me to the hospital, and for Denise to call me so he could tell me what had happened. Once we arrived at the hospital, it took us a while to jump through the hoops of the information desk, calling around to find out which floor he was actually on, then going to one nursing station, only to be directed to another nursing station, finally finding out that he was already in surgery, then being led to a waiting room to find Amara already there. She filled us in. Thankfully, the gunshot was a clean entry and exit. It was the best case scenario. They needed to clean up his shoulder and then stitch it closed. He was in surgery because he had several broken ribs and one had punctured his spleen, so they're having to remove it. I called Charlie's parents to tell them about what had happened and was surprised to hear Patricia answer the phone. She had arrived at Bruce and Denise's to play cards, and Denise had filled her in. Patricia drove all the way over there to stay with my kids so Charlie's parents could come up to the hospital. Not wanting them to go through that same maze of the nursing stations, Bruce went downstairs to meet them at the reception desk and then led them up to the surgical waiting room. A short while after their arrival, Charlie's manager and some other co-workers arrived. Everyone was really worried about him. Later, the surgeon came in to announce that the surgery went well. Charlie was in post-op, recovering, and we all breathed a collective sigh of relief. Sometime after midnight, Charlie's parents and I were seated in the patient room with him, and Charlie was still feeling the effects of the painkillers and the anesthesia. He was out for the count. Wyatt and his partner Juan arrived, and they had good news. Not 20 minutes after Denise's second 911 call came in, the police units surveying the area were looking for my stolen car when one of the units spotted it. It was pulled off to the side of a dark street adjacent to some railroad tracks. Apparently, these two idiots took my antiquated car over the railroad tracks a little too fast. This wiped out my oil pan, and they were forced to pull over to assess the damage. They realized they couldn't force the car to go much further without annihilating the engine, so they just decided to stay where they were. They started eating that pizza and were planning on pulling a gun on the first passerby who was kind enough for them to stop, and they would carjack them. They just didn't count on the first passerby being a police cruiser. Now these two morons were in jail. There is some scary news though. They were from San Antonio. Apparently, they were attempting to make their way across the border into Mexico. They were wanted for holding up three convenience stores, and in all three of those robberies, they had shot and killed the store clerk and any witnesses inside the store. They were wanted for five murders in San Antonio, or now and another one in El Paso. Certainly Charlie would have been number seven if he hadn't fought back. Charlie would go on to make a complete recovery, although it did take some time. His four front upper teeth were cracked from being struck with the butt of a gun. He would end up having all four teeth crowned. He needed physical therapy for his shoulder for several months. To this day, he still experiences some residual pain in it from time to time when he tries to lift it too far above his head. The owner of the pizza restaurant where Charlie had been working was amazing. He insisted on paying for all of Charlie's medical and dental bills. He also paid to fix my car. Not only did he cover Charlie's lost wages from the restaurant, he was also determined to pay for all of Charlie's lost wages from his family's construction business. We found out later from the manager. He asked the owner about filing a claim with their delivery insurance, and the owner told the manager that the insurance wouldn't cover this. It's not an accident one of my drivers is at fault for, and I wouldn't be found at fault for something unforeseen like this. But this is the right thing to do. We're a family. We're going to make sure that he's taken care of, because that's what family does. That's border culture for you, no matter where you live, where you were raised. My hope is that you can make your own border culture. Make a really big city feel like a small one. Surround yourself with people who are family, whether they're related to you or not, or maybe just feel like they are. Look out for one another in a crisis. Find connections and overcome obstacles that might separate you from other people. Don't let a muddy river divide you. Build a bridge over it. Oh, and maybe try some salsa with your turkey and stuffing this year at Thanksgiving, because it's delicious. Inside the lovely, small and touristy seaside town of Port Stephens, Australia, I live alone. Not a lot happens except for the bustle of the tourist in the summer. The rest of the year, the locals have the town and beautiful beaches all to ourselves. Everyone knows each other. It's safe to walk around any time of the day or night. I work at a local RSL, about 3 kilometers from my house, so I always walk to and from work, as most of us do. We also walk to and from the clubs on a night out, but as most of my friends live in the opposite direction, I usually do the walk alone, and this night was a night like any other. I would go to work, walk home, take a shower, then race back to the club for dancing and drinks with all my friends. As a side note to all of this, I love dancing, so I'm always excited to go out to the clubs. I have a fun reputation for being a joyful and encouraging friend to rage out on for as long as the club is open, so I can dance my feet off. It's just part of who I am. This night turned out to be anything like a normal one, though. First, let me tell you just a little bit more about myself. To my friends, I'm known as a fun-loving, down-to-earth, beach-hopping party girl. At work, I'm known for my dedication, professionalism, punctuality, and my pristinely dressed appearance. I'm a natural-born leader, and I'm well-regarded amongst my peers and colleagues alike. So when Saturday night rolled around, I was very excited about my evening shift inside that private a la carte dining room of the RSL where I was the managing hostess. I especially liked Saturdays, as it was our biggest night. The tips were always fantastic, and the club was always humming with locals and tourists mingling to have a great time. The club had a truly fun, palpable vibe on Saturday nights, with live bands upstairs, a disco downstairs, and a happy, friendly staff. This Saturday started out like any other. I got up and had this huge, healthy breakfast of bacon, eggs, fruit, and coffee. I got my uniform shipshape and considered my outfit for dancing after work, then walked to one of the pristine beaches for a body surf, maybe some sunbathing and reading. This little cove was located right in the middle of my community, so it was a daily place to commune with the neighbors, to catch up and just say good day. On this particular Saturday, there was nobody else in sight. I thought, well, it's getting towards the end of tourist season, so I guess that's that. Then it dawned on me. Today was the monthly market in town, so everyone was definitely there. I usually went, but it just had slipped from my mind, so I decided to enjoy having my favorite beach all to myself. I settled down after my surf to read my book, and as I was enjoying the second chapter, it hit me, out of the blue, like a ton of bricks. This sickening feeling racked my entire body. It was a cross between being watched and a powerful urge to get up and run for my life. The beach that I was on was a bit of a walk, and isolated from any main road or any other structure. I trusted my instincts, but didn't even bother getting dressed. I just bolted upright and took off, clad only in my bikini, clutching my book, water, and clothing all in one hand, so my other hand was free in case I needed to protect myself. As I reached the path that exited the beach, I took the uphill climb 3 leaps at a time. The ground was lined with these narrow wooden planks, a bit like railroad tracks, and over time, they drifted apart, making the track a little difficult to navigate. I went there regularly, though, and I'd become adept at skipping over them, several at a time. It was almost like a workout for me. As I was racing along that track, I thought I saw something off to my left, rustling in the bush, but I did not hesitate or stop to see what it was. I just kept running until I safely reached the sanctuary of the main road, where there was a few people enjoying the day themselves, on the calmer waters of the bayside. This was where most of the tourists would hang out, and I'm sure you can imagine my relief as I passed by on my way home for lunch, a nap, and eventually to get ready for work. But this is not the end of my story. I made sure to take the long way home, ducking and diving through secret paths and friendly neighborhood yards, where the owners were happy for you to use their land as a shortcut. When I approached my house, I walked into the neighbor's backyard, which was one of those safety houses that you can drop into if need be. I exited through my backyard, as they were connected, and went straight inside my home. I grabbed my cordless phone and peeked through the front curtain to see if I'd been followed. After standing there for what felt like an hour, when in fact was only about 10 minutes, I decided to just pull myself together, concentrate on the night ahead. I was determined to not let this experience get the better of me. I prepared myself a huge salad sandwich on my favorite rye bread and a cup of chamomile tea to calm my nerves and quiet my mind for my afternoon nap. Fast forward to the afternoon. I got up and took a long hot shower, did my hair in a tied up to do for work with no makeup, as I've never felt the need to wear any. I then proceeded to dress in my freshly ironed, favorite black pencil skirt with the fan split in the back that my mom had made for me, as it felt like it was having her close to me, and it gave me some comfort when I paired it with my crisp, white lace-colored shirt. The path that I always took to work was a backtrack, with a gated retirement village on one side and a thick, lovely Aussie subtropical bush on the other. It was quite secluded and shady, and I always went this way because my shift generally started at 5 p.m., when the sun was still high in the sky, and I could enjoy the cool breezes off the bay. As I walked along, I tried not to reflect on the day's events, just tried to focus and enjoy the flora and the fauna. I was determined to not let it spoil my beloved paradise home and the sense of safety that I've come to love and trust. I arrived safely at my work, strolling past a few colleagues, stopped for a bit of chit-chat, said some lows on my way to the staff room. I dropped my purse in the locker, prep for my shift, but didn't mention any of my day to anyone. The night went on without a hitch. The tips were enough for me to have a great night out. I almost forgot about that lurking dread that I felt earlier. Fortunately, one of my work friends was heading to her sister's house for the evening. She would be walking the same way I did to get home. As we walked along, we chatted, pulled out a couple of beers, and I greedily accepted one, knowing it would take the edge off of my still nagging gut feeling. All of a sudden, she burst out laughing, and I said, "What's so funny?" To which she said, "Gee, I know you like a drink, lady, but slow your roll. You'll be drunk before you even get home." I guess she noticed that I was kind of slamming that bottle, just giggled and shrugged it off, saying, "I was thirsty. Guess I didn't drink enough water at work tonight. We were super busy, you know?" She nodded along, as she knew that I was right. As we continued our walk home, we chatted about this and that. Then soon, it was time to part ways, and I asked her, "Are you definitely sleeping over at your sister's house tonight, like 100%? She answered with yes, but why do you sound so concerned? I said, not wanting to scare her, as my concern was a gut feeling and not just a fact, "Oh, no reason. Just thought we might catch up for breakfast." "Okay then, I will call you into yours in the morning, say about 10? She asked. "Sounds great. Good night," I said. And with that, I wandered off in the direction of my house. I didn't have very far to go, maybe 50 meters. After quickly parting, I was home, still feeling nervous. I used that same entry strategy as before, entering the back of the next door's yard and then into my home, where I left my phone at the back door and most of the lights and TV on. It really made it look like someone was home from the outside. I locked the door behind me, then quickly finished my beer and jumped into the shower to wash off the night's work and wet my hair, to let my full head of bouncy curls spring back to life. While enjoying my second beer, I dried off, and I got dressed as fast as I possibly could of a slinky dress and boots that I picked out earlier. By this time, it was about 10:30 p.m. I was excited to walk back to the club for a dance, a few more beers, and some fun with my friends. At this point, I was contemplating taking the longer route along the main road for safety, but I guess just being young and maybe a bit impatient, I was determined to get back to the club as fast as I possibly could. I proceeded to use my normal track, the one that I mentioned earlier. This one was far less safe at night, because of all the retirees in the village were definitely in bed by now. There would be no lights to shine my way, just the eerie, inky darkness, and the bush noises that I usually really enjoyed. Then, it happened. About 3 minutes into my walk, I heard heavy footsteps behind me, far away at first, like maybe around 50 meters. My gut sank and my heart started to race uncontrollably. I started to walk a little faster, but then, so did the unknown heavy footsteps behind me, Fear was overtaking every fiber of my being, and I quickened my pace again. I never turned around so as to not lose any precious seconds of my head start. But the faster I walked, the faster those steps behind me moved, always matching my pace, but somehow advancing on me. My mind raced as I tried to form an exit strategy, because I simply couldn't duck into the village as it was gated with high walls. I didn't want to start singing out or screaming, as it would waste my energy and only give my assailant more resolve. No one would hear me over the surf. As I said earlier, there were no mobile phones back then. I lobbed high into the air of what was left of my beer, about half a can over my right shoulder, hoping to somehow hit them in the head, but no such luck. And then I remembered, about halfway along the track, about 10 meters in front of me, was a second exit to a cul-de-sac that led up to the main road and a street-lit path. With all the energy that I could muster, I started to run. But then, it hit me as though a plate of thick hot steel had landed on my back. A deep, gruff voice, menacing and cruel, said,
"Yeah, you better run."
That was all the encouragement I needed. I ran all the way to the club where my friends were waiting for me at the front door. Noticing my distress, they raced over to me, and after explaining my whole day to them, a few of the boys took off at top speed on foot to go out and look for him. They returned around a half an hour later with nothing to report. I was relieved to be safe and just wanted to forget about the whole thing. Well, I did have another drink or two and of course a dance. It wasn't as much fun as usual. I never did go down that path again after dark, at least not by myself. I've never been the same since I lost my sense of freedom, innocence, and safety. It was a hard lesson to learn, but it's the reality of the world that we live in. Even in your own neighborhood, you never know who's watching. In 1978, my dad got a job in Las Vegas, Nevada, and we moved there from Houston, Texas. At that time, Las Vegas was not a very large city, but very quickly growing. I was only 13 years old at the time, and I was a very small girl for my age. The other thing about Vegas, and I think we all know this, is that it was already established as a crime city, but the 70s brought on this whole new revival of activity. Lots of evasion happened in Vegas, as people could disappear in the rapidly expanding underbelly. Lots of murders went on, usually inner city, but bodies would turn up in the desert ever so often. My parents bought a house on the outskirts of town, as they were a lot more affordable. It was a brand new house in a brand new neighborhood. There were a few homes being constructed, but only about 5 homes were actually occupied at the time. All the rest of the neighborhood was just kind of empty dirt lots. Being a young girl, I was definitely the only kid out there, and stood out like a tiny sore thumb. There weren't many people, so if I was out and about, it was obvious that I was just a child. I'd never lived in the desert before, and wasn't used to the sandy landscape. It was one color everywhere you looked, so when something was out of place, it didn't take long to notice it. People, cars, animals in the distance, unless it was wearing beige, it was a big smudge against the otherwise placid backdrop. With such limited neighbors, we saw the same cars day in and day out. When someone was new in the neighborhood, we would know immediately. One afternoon, I took my mom's bike out for a ride with the family poodle in her little basket on the front of the bike. This bike was a little too big for me, so I wasn't that good at riding it, but I was bored and just wanted to be outside. I was riding around on empty streets of the neighborhood. At one point, I realized that I was riding down this cul-de-sac. As I start to turn around, I realize a big black car had driven up right behind me. It was one of those big old 1970s Cadillacs. The windows were dark and tinted, so you couldn't see inside at all. As there were no other houses on the street at all, it was just empty lots. I quickly realized that I might be in serious trouble here. In a panic, I rode my bike onto one of the vacant lots. Not knowing the desert, I immediately got stuck in that sandy, deep terrain. I lost control of my mom's big bike and fell over onto my side. My dog was thrown out of the basket and started running away because she was scared too. By now, the driver had gotten out of his car and was quickly coming after me. He was this huge man, dark and terrifying. He had this menacing look in his eyes that made my blood run cold. He never said a word. He just had this scary intent in his expression. I was all tangled up in that bike, desperately trying to get up and run away. But the tires of the bike and my shoes were stuck in that soft sand. My heart was pounding so hard that I thought it might burst. I was shaking violently with extreme fear. This made me clumsy and slowed down my efforts to get up. Just as he came around the front of his car and was heading straight for me, another car drove up between him and me. To my surprise, it was one of those few neighbors that we had. He got out of his car and asked what was going on, and asked if I was okay. At this, that big, dark, scary man turned around and got right back in his car, never saying a word. Just got back in and drove away. It was ominous, and I could tell even my neighbor was put off by that stranger's energy. It was clear that something was off about the situation. It was just me and that big shady fellow. Getting to me was his only priority. The second that neighbor showed up, it was like he'd never even seen me. The look on his face told a different story, though. The man was furious and made no effort to hide it. My neighbor helped me get up. I was shaking and crying with relief. He helped me get my dog and then put my bike back onto the paved street. Followed me home to make sure that man did not come back to get me. If one of those few neighbors hadn't been driving home during that instance and saw that unusual situation, I know that man would have caught me. I wonder even now, many, many years later, what could have happened to me. I'm positive that I was saved that day from a horrible fate, like rape or even human trafficking, maybe even worse. Whenever I remember that time, I thank God that I was rescued by my neighbor. In 2003, I was a real estate agent in Albuquerque, New Mexico. As a new agent, I was always trying to find ways to get new clients. One such method was to hold open houses. Many of the more seasoned agents would let the new agents hold open houses on their listings. These little open houses made the home feel neighborly, like I was selling a property that I lived in or something. It was a good way to get to know people inside the neighborhood, develop leads, and build up a rapport with people who may sell their home in the future. Being a young woman at the time, I would always try to find a male agent to host the open house with me. On one occasion, my coworker Richard agreed to assist me at an open house. The home was located in a relatively upscale neighborhood. Also, it was one of the few homes in Albuquerque that actually had a basement. It was nearing the end of our open house when a coworker received a call from one of his clients. They wanted him to go right then to show them a new home that had just come up for sale. It was about 15 minutes before our open house was to end for the day, and then Richard asked if I minded if he left early. This means that I would have to close up the house and then gather up any signage that we used to bring potential buyers into the house itself. I told him that I didn't mind and to go ahead and meet his client. After Richard left, I was getting ready to go through the house and shut off all the lights and lock up. During this time, one single man walked in. I told him that I was in the process of closing up the open house, and he asked if he could take a quick look at it, promised me he wouldn't take long. I was at first reluctant to agree, but ultimately decided to let him have a look. He could be a new buyer for me. I asked for him to sign my register for the visitors. He said sure, and then wrote his name in the registry book. But after he signed his name, immediately proceeded to scribble over his name that he just wrote so it couldn't be read. This gesture immediately gave me that creep vibe, and I suddenly felt like I didn't want to be alone inside this house with this man. I told him to go ahead and walk around on his own while I packed up my stuff. He said okay, but then asked if I would at least show him around the basement. And this immediately sent that creep vibe up another notch. I tried to politely tell him he was welcome to go have a look by himself. I did not want to go alone down into a basement with this man. It felt like a very bad idea. He looked at me for a long while. It felt like he was weighing the idea of us going down to the basement together. Then he abruptly just said, "No problem," and headed down the stairs himself. I quickly gathered up all my belongings, ran through the house, turning off all the lights and making sure all the doors were locked, except for the front door. I wanted away from this guy as soon as possible. As he came back up the stairs, I lied and told him that I had a client contact me. They wanted to meet me right away at another home for sale. I apologized to him, saying that I don't have time for him to look at the rest of the house. He looked a little irritated that I was hurrying him out the door to meet up with another buyer, but I didn't care how he felt at the moment. I just knew that I wanted away from him. Again, he stared at me for a long moment. Then he just shrugged his shoulders and again said, "No problem." As soon as he walked out the front door, I closed and locked it. I watched him from the window as he got into his car and drove away. I had a feeling that I just saved myself from some kind of very bad situation. And lo and behold, I would be right. The next evening, I was at my house watching the local news. The news agent was saying that the evening before, a local real estate agent had been murdered at his open house. The home itself was located in a very affluent neighborhood in the Northeast Heights. It was not far from the home where I just held that open house at. The house where the murder had taken place had security cameras, both inside and outside. The police were able to get a good look at the suspect and get a photo from the video itself. The news showed a photo of the suspect taken from those security cameras. I was horrified to see that it was that same creepy man that visited my open house. I knew then, when he was giving me those long, creepy stares, it was him trying to decide whether he wanted to kill me or not. I shudder today just to think that he would have done just that had I gone downstairs with him into that basement. After the news story, I decided I would never host an open house again without a male agent with me, and I would never volunteer to close up another open house by myself. I am very lucky to have been spared that night and not to have had the same fate as that poor unfortunate real estate agent that was killed.